History Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Nishad Carrington. Now, this week we're actually going to be finishing up part two of our episode series on Haile Selassie. But as last week's episode centered on his life and politics and his influence on the Ethiopian environment, this week's episode we're going to shift gears a little bit and we're actually going to focus a whole lot more on his legacy. Now, that focus on his legacy is actually going to require kind of a thorough explanation of the meanings and belief of Rastafari. So at this point, if you have not listened to part one of this series right here, just the last episode, I would encourage you to do that first, because there's going to be a lot that is explained about his life that actually has a good bit to do with today's episode. So if that's the case, pause right here. I'll give you a second. Go back, listen to episode one. It's only about 35 minutes long, and come back and join us and just kind of flow right through it. I think you'll really get where we're going. Now, even further, allow me to preface this episode with the fact that there are different schools of thought as to the belief in Rastafari, including some people and participants and believers actually seeing it more as a way of life and others seeing it more as a religion. So for the purposes of this episode, and as you all know who have come to listen and enjoy these series, we don't really want to be disrespectful to anyone. We don't want to disrespect anyone's belief or religions or, you know, schools of thought, because you'll lose the message there in the history of what we're trying to teach. So instead, for the purpose of this episode and to be respectful to the belief and the members or believers, we will refer to Rastafari throughout as a movement. You know, so I hope that doesn't dissuade anyone or hurt any feelings, but that's the best way we can do it. Instead of referring to it as a religion or a belief, a movement is the way that we'll do it. So right now, I think I want to take a moment just to kind of clear up a common colloquialism, if you will. You may notice that, except in the title of this episode, we haven't and we won't use the term Rastafarianism. Many, and if not most, Rastafari actually don't like to be referred to or referenced in that way. Now, the reason for this stems from their philosophy and their belief, which we'll actually get to in greater detail later. But the philosophy essentially caters and centers around a belief that, quote, eons and isms represent a corrupt Babylonian system that is responsible for the oppressions of people all over the world. So thus, to consider themselves a religion or an ism of any sort is really seen as accepting a system that is counter entirely to what they believe. Now, also speaking of religion, right here it should be important to note that while we will maintain a stance of religious neutrality and, again, most importantly, tolerance, in this episode, we will make numerous references to the Bible, its verses, and its text. Now, these are neither in promotion or endorsement of the text or the teachings of the Bible, but in order to completely relay the background and belief of Rastafari, we must provide these reference points. So let's start and kind of get a quick recap to the end of Selassie's days, and I'd really be remiss if, again, I didn't encourage you to pause right here and go back and listen to last week's episode in totality if you hadn't already heard it, just so you have the full story, because this is just going to be a snippet in a piece. I definitely don't want you to not tune in here and miss this piece of misunderstood history, but, you know, either way, at the end of last week, we actually find that Selassie has passed away from questionable circumstances, at best natural causes, and probably at worst assassination. However, prior to the coup and house arrest, Selassie delivered Ethiopia into an African power that was recognized on the international stage, especially after what amounted into a triumphant march back into the country to overthrow the Italians under the direction then of Mussolini. So Rastafari is generally believed to have been founded in November of 1930. Now, if you recall back to part one, that is actually the same month and year that Selassie ascended the throne of power in Ethiopia. However, the movement was actually based on the social activism and cultural movements of the 1920s that was heavily influenced by Marcus Garvey. Let me take an aside again here. I encourage you as well, if you haven't already done so, go back and listen to the episode on Marcus Garvey. As you'll see in this episode, just like it was mentioned in that one, he had a huge impact on many movements, cultural, political, and as in this case here, a religious standpoint towards the African diaspora, right? So in the Rastafari movement, Garvey in fact is seen as a prophet. And while he was not a member of the movement, he certainly was very, very vocal when it came to Black empowerment. So again, if you haven't listened to the Garvey Movement episode, or if you haven't listened to part one of this one, go back and listen to those two, and then you'll be caught up to here. So most importantly, and what really provides the greatest legitimacy to the holy nature of Selassie to Rastas, is the prophecy of Marcus Garvey, when in 1920 he proclaimed,
"Look to Africa, where a black king shall be crowned. He shall be the redeemer."
So these words that Marcus Garvey spoke then, they were very quickly followed by the ascension of Selassie to the throne just 10 years later. And so when Selassie was actually crowned emperor, many believed that Garvey's words had come true. And essentially, Selassie is regarded as the god of the black race. Now, to support this claim that God is black, Rastas look to the biblical text found in Jeremiah 8:21.
"For the hurt of the daughter of my people as I hurt, I am black, as astonishment hath taken hold of me."
Now, at the time of Selassie's crowning, the King of England, who at that time was regarded by many as the most powerful man in the world because of the size of the British Empire, was unable to attend. But in his place, he sent the Duke of Gloucester to represent himself and the English crown. Now, when greeting Selassie, the Duke actually bowed before him, which many Rastas regard and believe revealed that the Ethiopian emperor was more important than the most important man in the world. Now, at this point, allow us to move ahead a little bit to the actual belief system of the Rastafari movement, and then we'll move to the present day situation of the Rastas, okay? So that's just a little bit of background as to the ascension of Selassie and the relationship to Garvey along the way. Now, there are really three main sects of Rastafari, and they also go by the name of mansions, right? So, but it's very, very tough to actually narrow down how many mansions there could be, with some sources citing three and other sources citing six. Now, at this point, please feel free, if you are in the know or if you're a Rastafari scholar or even a Rasta, to provide us with clarifying points to this. We'd love to know, and we'll be sure to read any received information into a later episode, okay? Because again, we don't want to ever offend anyone. If you feel like you were misrepresented right here, let us know. So as usual, we will ask for forgiveness in the event that I mispronounce any names or persons here, okay? So the first mansion of Rastafari is known as Nabingi. And this is the oldest of all Rastafari orders. The name is actually derived from Queen Nabingi, who ruled Uganda in the 19th century and fought against the British Empire. Now, if you notice from our website and our future episodes to come, we will actually be doing a full episode on Queen Nabingi as well. So hold on for that one to get the full history. This Nabingi that we're referring to is strictly a mansion of Rastafari, okay? So the members of this mansion, they were actually the first to proclaim that Emperor Haile Selassie was the incarnation of the supreme deity, okay? So Nabingi also pushed for repatriation to Ethiopia. All right, so the next mansion we'll talk about is actually the Bobo Shanti. And now, this name is actually derived from Bobo, which stands for black, and Ashanti, which is a tribe from Ghana. Now, I'm sure you, Paul, have probably heard of Ashanti, probably never heard of Bobo, other than thinking of maybe a clown in some sort of comedic reference, but Bobo Shanti, all right? So the Bobo Shanti is believed that most of the slaves brought to Jamaica were from the Ashanti tribe. Now, Prince Emmanuel Charles Edwards founded the Bobo Shanti order in Jamaica in the 1950s. He, along with his descendants and Haile Selassie, are seen as gods. Marcus Garvey is regarded as a prophet, and the Bobo Shanti also believe that black people should be compensated financially for slavery. Sounds like we have another group that is asking for reparations. Not to say that they aren't well-deserved, especially for the founding of the United States. Now, the Bobo Shanti, they wear very, very long robes and very tightly wrapped turbans, and they do not eat salt or oil. We will get to the diet of the Rastas, but the Bobo Shanti do not eat salt or oil in addition to the rest of the dietary restrictions of the Rastas. Now, the third one that we'll refer to as the main tribe is the 12 Tribes. That's their name, the 12 Tribes. Now, this sect was actually found in 1968 by Dr. Vernon Carrington. There's no relation that I know of, but I need to check into that, actually. Dr. Vernon Carrington, who also goes by the name Prophet Gad, and it is the most liberal of all of the Rastafari orders. 12 tribe members are free to worship in a church of their choosing or at home. They consider themselves the direct descendants of the 12 sons of Jacob. They are also divided into 12 houses, which are determined by your birth month, and each house is represented by a different color. Their most famous member of the 12 tribes is actually Bob Marley. So if you were ever wondering if he was a Rasta, he was. He was a member of the 12 tribes. Now, for anyone who may not know, allow us to just take a second and back up a little bit here, okay? So Rastafari and Selassie are connected because while they may be different sects of the movement, which we'll get into greater detail in the second half of this episode, the unifying beliefs and aspects of the movement really is the belief in the divinity, or really lack for a better word, the messiahship of Haile Selassie, the influence of Jamaican culture, the resistance of oppression, and a resounding pride in African heritage, okay? So many Rastafarians actually trace Selassie's lineage back to King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. We will have a future episode on Queen Sheba. You know, we'll may need to make some plans to cover King Solomon as well. Now, if you remember back to part one of this, we actually referred to this and we said we'd get to it in part two. Well, here it is. In the Book of Kings, more specifically in 1 Kings 10, 1 to 13, there is a textual reference to a visit being made by the Queen of Sheba to King Solomon. Now, Rastafari believe that King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba had sex during this visit, and this union actually led to the conception of a child in the same line of descendants as Selassie. Okay? Now, as many religions believe in a heaven and hell, Rastafari is no different, with the prevailing notion being that Ethiopia is their homeland, and that they eventually will return. Now, owing to kind of the course of history and colonization and the subsequent division of Africa, led to many, many Africans being divided up and sent to destinations all across the world, and in most cases actually being sent as slaves to Caucasians. This is why and how many Africans found themselves in Jamaica, and why Jamaica is regarded by Rastas as hell. So in converse, Ethiopia is regarded as the homeland, a place with fond memories of freedom and a life prior to oppression, and Africa is their version of Zion, a virtual paradise on earth, and thus the goal of many Rastafari is to move back to Africa. Now, eventually, it kind of became regarded as heaven, and not just Africa being regarded as heaven, but more specifically Ethiopia, okay? So for this line of belief, Rastas refer to Psalms 137:1.
By the rivers of Babylon, we sat down. There we wept when we remembered Zion.
Now, Garvey's Back to Africa is and was treated as synonymous with essentially being back to Ethiopia. For many, this is really more of a cultural desire than solely religious belief, and makes perfect sense in the light of oppression faced in the light of colonialism. Now, for this reason, it is more than just returning to Africa for the Rasta. It's about building Africa into something even better, preserving African culture, and celebrating a way of life that many feel the Babylonian society tried to take away. Now, in the Bible, Babylon is a literal city in the Old Testament, and the word means confusion. But it also represents corruption, idolatry, and a fallen system in the New Testament. To this day, this is the view that's actually held by many Rastas when referring to Babylon. They are referring to any city that is not Zion, usually meaning any modern, capitalistic, evil society. Now, you heard the quote from the Bible, Psalms 137:1. By the rivers of Babylon we sat down, there we wept when we remembered Zion. Historically, however, the rivers of Babylon were considered to be the famed Tigris and Euphrates. However, lending a little bit of credence to this claim is that historians link more than just the two rivers. They in fact list four rivers: the Hiddekel, also known as the Tigris, the Euphrates, the Pison, and the Gihon rivers. The Gihon River, if to be believed, runs through the present-day Red Sea and into Ethiopia. If the movement of the Rastafari is to be believed, then the location of heaven may just be correct, as these rivers begin in the mountains of present-day Syria on the Iraq border. They flow through present-day Lebanon, Israel, Jordan, Egypt, the Red Sea, and then ended in the Arabian Sea. But most importantly, Most importantly, these rivers flow directly through Addis Ababa, the capital city of Ethiopia. Now, Rastafari in general believe that repatriation to Ethiopia will be led by Selassie, where they will no longer be repressed or suppressed, and they will live in freedom. Now, we have done and we'll have to do a little bit of back and forth jumping during this episode, so please bear with me, right? It can be a little bit tough sometimes to weave religious belief with historical activities, as the two don't always travel on the same linear path. But as we discussed in part one, one of the titles that was given to Selassie was Rastafari. Since listeners are unable to see this written, I'll do you a little bit of a favor and I'll make it clear that even though Rastafari, the movement, is written as one word, his name, Rastafari, is spelled as two separate words, R-A-S and then T-A-F-A-R-I, with the term Jah also often being placed in front of Rastafari to bestow upon Selassie the title of Lord. So it means Jah Rastafari, okay? So it's necessary to point out here as well, and I know I've probably had more asides in this first 5 to 10 minutes of this episode than we've had in all others prior total, but I just wanna really make sure that we're covering all the bases here, okay? So again, Selassie never regarded himself as a god, and he did not adhere to Rastafari. If you recall from part one, Selassie was actually a practicing Christian, and that's actually what helped him to rise to power in the majority Christian country of Ethiopia. In an interview, when he was asked about this reverence and worship, stated,
"I am a mere man. I will be replaced by the oncoming generation, and a human being should not be emulated for a deity."
Now, it's got to be kind of crazy, if you really think about it, to be able to speak to people about your feelings of being regarded as a deity, right? I don't think we really had that in the course of history, especially not in the time that we actually have recorded history. So, you know, obviously Jesus may have had, you know, followers who regarded him as the Son of God and him as a, you know, edified individual. But we didn't quite have the recorded history the way we did when Selassie, you know, was able to give these interviews in the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s regarding this movement that he sparked just by his ascension to the throne. So it's got to be a little weird. It's got to be kind of a surreal feeling, I have to imagine. You know, just picture yourself taking that kind of role and being able to give an interview about a whole mass movement of people who are following you just because you're you. Now, coincidentally though, Selassie is revered as the Messiah, but many Rastas believe that it was never Selassie himself who was Christ, but instead the lion spirit within him. Thus, you'll often hear the phrase regarding the Lion of Zion. Now, this is the point here where some things and beliefs in the movement can get a little bit confusing to those not knowing otherwise. So the best I can ask is to just try your best to keep up, and I'll try my best to keep it clear for you as well. Now, some Rastas deny that Selassie was a deity and worship Jesus Christ as the Messiah, but to most Rastas, he's actually the Redeemer, and Africa and Ethiopia, more specifically, is the proverbial promised land. Now, right here, we're just going to take a pause for one of our sponsors, Make Music Count. We'll be right back after that with kind of Rastafari at the individual level and their beliefs.
Make Music Count. The mission of Make Music Count is to increase elementary and secondary students' mathematical skill development through piano playing and reducing their math anxiety. By incorporating music into each lesson, students become engaged through music while simultaneously learning mathematical concepts. Each lesson is based on learning musical notes in a song. Each note is derived through a mathematical equation that varies from addition and subtraction all the way up to algebraic equations. Therefore, solving math equations leads directly to playing the piano and a much more positive attitude towards math. If you are an educator or in youth development, check out our friends at MakeMusicCount.com. Now back to the show.
So what is the movement of Rastafari all about at the individual level? So first we'll tackle the dreadlocks. Well, that's also where the Rastafari lifestyle comes in. Rastas do not believe in cutting or combing their hair, and this too has biblical derivations, as the Rastas see themselves as one of the 12 tribes of Israel, owing to Numbers 6:5.
All the days of the vow of his separation, there shall no razor come upon his head until the days be fulfilled, in which he separateth himself unto the Lord. He shall be holy and shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow.
Now, there's more than just number 6-5 that's associated with this hair growth. It's also in Leviticus 21:5 as well.
They shall not make baldness upon their head, neither shall they shave off the corner of their beard, nor make any cuttings in the flesh.
Now, it's been suggested that the first Rasta's locks were actually copied from the Mau Mau insurgents who grew their locks while hiding in the mountains of Kenya in 1953 during their struggle for independence. However, there's also additional information that really suggests that the first traces came from a hair-locked subgroup called the Young Black Faith in 1949. Now, the lengths of a Rasta's locks is really a measure of wisdom and maturity and knowledge, in that it can indicate not only a Rasta's age, but also his or her time as a Rasta as well. Now, further, according to the Bible, the strongest man to live, Samson, was a Nazirite who had 7 locks, and the Rastafari argue that these 7 locks could only have been dreadlocks, as it is highly unlikely to refer to 7 individual strands of hair. Now, locks have also come to represent and symbolize the Lion of Judah's mane and rebellion against Babylon, and Rastafari associate locks with a spiritual journey that one takes in the process of growing their hair. There is believed to be a cleansing spiritual journey that takes place, and it's taught that patience is the key to growing locks, that being a journey of the mind, soul, and spirituality, and again, allowing no cutting or combing or brushing. The way to grow natural locks is simply to wash them with pure water and herbal shampoo. Now, to that point, you know, I can really understand the belief that there's a spiritual journey that comes along with the growing of hair process. You know, I've never had locks in my life. I've grown my hair to the best I could say is a baby afro. But it's been tough because it really is a patience and almost a spiritual cleansing that goes along with it, because, you know, especially in the society that we live in now, where we want everything now, when you're growing your hair, you have to be patient. You really have to be patient. Now, I don't know if I personally could go with the no brushing or combing. I don't know if I could do that. But hey, you know, there's other parts of the Rastafari lifestyle that I don't know that I could deal with. And the next is the vegetarian diet. So in addition to the outward appearance of dreadlocks, Rastas also tend to have a penchant for smoking marijuana, which we will touch to a bit later, as well as leading a vegetarian lifestyle. Now, the marijuana we're going to get to, believe me, it's huge, especially a lot of the misconceptions that come along with it. So we're going to address those too. Now, the lifestyle of the Rasta is an outward reminder to practitioners that they've made a covenant with Jah and within themselves to live a natural lifestyle. The vegetarian covenant is derived from the Rasta's atal lifestyle, or vital, meaning the intent to promote life in all of its forms, animals included. The vegetarian lifestyle is one of the main tenets of the Rastafari movement. Those who strictly adhere to it abstain from all meat and flesh, asserting that to touch meat is to touch death, and therefore in direct contradiction to Nazirite law, which is derived from the Bible. Now, that is not to say that all Rastas do not eat meat. Some will eat a limited diet of meat, generally in accordance with the Old Testament laws, but connecting with those means that they will not eat shellfish or pork. Now, some are vegetarian, but will eat fish, but abstain from other forms of flesh, but most will maintain a vegetarian or vegan lifestyle at all times. Now, consuming alcohol is generally deemed to be unhealthy in the Rastafari way of life, primarily because it's seen as a tool of Babylon to confuse people, and partially because alcohol is something fermented and within the body is felt to be much like turning the body into a proverbial cemetery. Now, because of the removal of what is considered to be unhealthy elements, the Rastafari lifestyle promotes and prefers natural vegetables and fruits such as coconuts and mangoes, and all of those can obviously easily be found throughout the Caribbean and is widely available in most restaurants. Now, then again, other mansions do not specify a diet except to proclaim and espouse what Jesus said in the New Testament. Is not what goes into a man's mouth that defile him, but what come out of it. So, as we mentioned before, The exact belief system of the Rastafari is very tough to pinpoint, as there is no one set of belief. There are multiple mansions of the movement, and the actual numbers of Rastas and those proclaiming to live the Rasta lifestyle is virtually impossible to pinpoint. Now, further, the Rastafari lifestyle and way of life rejects what is considered the degenerative elements of society, those being materialism, oppression, and sensual pleasures. And all of those are referred to as Babylon. And in fact, a huge part of the clean living lifestyle that the Rastas partake in is due to the fact that Rastas assert that their own body is the true temple of God. Now, while this be the case in many locations with larger Rastafari populations, they have built tabernacles and churches and headquarters and temples as spiritual meeting centers. Now, particularly, tabernacles are seen as a place of worship for the Rastafari, with the Nabingi worshiping in tents and the Bobo Shanti having Bobo camps where they come together and worship. Now we'll touch to the lion in the room, marijuana. Now, Rastas sometimes refer to it as, quote, wisdom weed, and believe that the plant first grew from the grave of King Solomon, who the Bible refers to as one of the wisest men to ever walk the planet. Even more, the smoking of marijuana is not for recreational purposes, but it is instead believed to be a food that feeds the spirit of the Rasta. Smoking marijuana is a spiritual act for the Rastas, and it's often accompanied by reading and the studying of the Bible, and it's considered a sacrament that cleans both the body and the mind. It heals the soul, it heightens the level of consciousness, it encourages peacefulness, it brings forth pleasure, and brings one closer to Jah. And in fact, there is Rastafari ceremony to the smoking of the marijuana herb as well. It's called a reasoning. This is actually a ceremony where Rastas will gather together, they'll smoke, and they'll discuss. In the event there is a person being honored, this person is permitted to light the herb, saying a short sentence beforehand, and then the herb is passed in a clockwise fashion. It is a widely held belief that this session is meant and used to reason with Jah. Now, to many Rastas, the fact that marijuana is illegal in many countries across the world is direct evidence that the persecution of the Rastafari is a reality. To the Rastafari, the illegality is not so much a surprise as when they view the powerful substance as meant to open the mind to the truth, which the Babylonian system does not want. However, they contrast this illegality with the legal nature of alcohol and other drugs, which, as mentioned, they feel are meant to have the effect of destroying the mind. Okay. So while Rastas believe in a herbal connection to reason with Jah, and you know, Christians believe in a genuflection to create the same, you know, in that connection with Jesus, I'm not sure if there are other religions out there that actually use a sort of supplement to increase or enhance the connection between their believed creator in some way. It's just very interesting to me that, you know, they do believe that there is supposed to be an opening of the mind. And I've heard this many a times, you know, and I've been in the presence of those smoking marijuana, and often they speak and they talk. I don't know if a lot of times the things that I've witnessed people saying are, you know, opening the soul to deep thinking, but there is definitely a certain congeniality that happens when people are sharing the marijuana herb. So what about the political stance of Rastafari? You know, and though the idealization and prophetization of Marcus Garvey exists in not only the Jamaican culture, but most assuredly within the Rastafari culture and movement, in the early stages, most Rastas did not and would not vote. And as we mentioned in the Garvey episode, he was responsible in 1929 for establishing the People's Political Party, and Selassie actually ascended to power in the confines of the imperial government as well. To me, it's actually kind of ironic that the earliest Rastas refused to partake in politics, and yet the two people who were held in some of the highest esteem for them were heavily involved in politics. In 1962 Jamaican elections, this actually came back to hurt one of their own. Ross Sam Brown formed the Suffering People's Party, but he received less than 100 votes. But by 1972, the politically minded Jamaicans began to revamp their appeal. And with the leader of the People's National Party, Michael Manley, using a prop to solicit the necessary participation from his fellow Rastas, he actually used a walking stick that he had been given by Selassie himself. during his visit to Jamaica, and he called this stick the Rod of Correction. Now, the famed reggae singer Peter Tosh furthered the movement to politicism in 1978 with a concert where he criticized the audience and the social climate at the time. And among other things, he demanded the decriminalization of marijuana. Obviously, Rastas would heavily support this. Now, he did this all while he was smoking marijuana on the stage. Now, at the same concert, Bob Marley, which I'm pretty sure listeners were waiting for me to mention in relation to Rastafari, outside of just mentioning that he was, you know, his mansion that he was a part of, appeared on stage with the then leader, with the then prime minister and opposition leader, raising their hands above their heads, interlocked in a show of solidarity, you know, through what had been overly violent election campaign. So Rastafari obviously maintained a peaceful mindset and a cohesive and collaborative mindset. Also, of course, while supporting the decriminalization of marijuana. In direct relation to the Rasta belief that all life has value and an equal value at that, Rastas tend to be very firm in adherence to the proposition that in the eyes of Jah, all men and women deserve equal rights and justice, equal treatment, and equal respect. And according to the Rastas, all people are equal, regardless of race, and really they owe that to the fact that all people are the children of Jah. Now, keeping with the deification of Selassie in a 1968 interview, he stated that the Almighty taught us that all human beings are equal regardless of sex, national origin, and tribe. And he also taught us all who seek him shall find him. Okay, so that's what owes to that kind of stance of the Rastas on human rights issues. Now, though Rastafari is not a religion, but a movement, it's really founded on many, many Christian or Protestant principles, including that on the viewpoint regarding homosexuality. There are many in the Rastafari movement that consider homosexual acts to be a Babylon-promoted sin against Jah. The Bobo Ashanti Mansion have been the most noted for their stance against homosexuality, with other mansions actually having kind of varying degrees of severity against the stance. But just as any other religion, belief, or movement, the Rastafari have a number of symbols that are representative of their way of life. And for the Rastafari, the colors green, gold, and red, sometimes including the color black, are commonly sported on flags and icons and badges and posters. And the green, gold, and red represent the colors of the Ethiopian flag and exhibit the loyalty the Rastafari feel, obviously, towards the Ethiopian state during the reign of Selassie. The red, black, and green were the colors that, you know, as we discussed with Garvey, were used to represent Africa and black liberation. As with other elements of the movement, even the representation of colors has variation that are open to interpretation and are really kind of subject to personal preference as well. As well, the Ethiopian flag has different meanings for different members. The proper orientation of the flag from bottom to top is red, gold, and green. And many members of the movement use them in different orientation or completely opposite as well. But regardless of the orientation of the colors always have the same associative meanings, with red actually signifying the blood of the martyrs, green being the vegetation and the beauty of Ethiopia, and gold representing the wealth of Africa. Okay, so if you also recall from part one, and I know I've done a lot of jumping back in reference to part one, but again, the two episodes go hand in hand. In May of 1941, Selassie and his military of Ethiopian patriots, they were backed in large part by a coalition, obviously, of forces from England, Free France, and Free Belgium, marched back into Addis Ababa. And they did this to overthrow the Italians who attempted to recolonize Ethiopia. And in 1948, Selassie gifted about 500 acres of land south of Addis Ababa to black people from the West who had supported him in his struggles with Mussolini in Italy. So the first settlers to arrive were African-American Jews, but many of them actually soon moved to Liberia or Israel. Then in 1963, dozens of Rastafari arrived and the population number swelled after Selassie made his emotional visit to Jamaica 3 years after this in 1966. Okay, so the original official line of the visit to Jamaica was diplomatic in nature. But some people actually tend to believe that Selassie actually wanted to meet the Rastafari and learn about the people who were worshiping him as another coming of the Messiah. Now, the crowds that were there to receive him made an incredible amount of noise, and it was to the extent that such it delayed his coming off the plane for fears of potential safety concerns. Obviously, that wasn't the case. These people revered this man as a god. But while in Jamaica, Selassie had the opportunity to meet with leading members of the movement. And while there isn't much recorded as to what was said between the two groups, it is believed that he encouraged them to fix things at home in Jamaica prior to returning to Africa. In fact, this visit to Jamaica of Selassie was so vital to the Rastafari movement. The visit occurred on April 21st. It is known in the Rastafari movement as Groundation Day, and it's observed as one of the more important holy days. However, there are other recognized groundations as well, those being January 7th, the Ethiopian Orthodox Christmas, March 25th, Empress Menen's birthday, that was Selassie's wife, Menen, May 25th, which is African Liberation Day, June 16th, which is Leonard Howell's birthday. Leonard Howell was actually one of the first preachers of the Rastafari movement, and his birthday is revered as a holiday. July 23rd, which was Selassie's birthday. Marcus Garvey's birthday is celebrated as well. September 11th is celebrated, and not because of September 11th, New York City, but because of the celebration of the Ethiopian New Year. And the final one is actually the coronation of Selassie as well. So rough estimates put the total number of Rastas worldwide anywhere between 100,000 and 1 million. And of that number today, there are approximately only 800 Rastas living in the major cities of Ethiopia, actually being a very, very small portion of the population. But considering the circumstances that brought Selassie down from power, again, episode one, part one, how do Rastas and ethnic Ethiopians get along today? In fact, the past and present of these neighbors is really kind of checkered. If you remember backward in 1974, the Derg regime overthrew and imprisoned Selassie. And as a result, they began to purge the country and the government of all remnants of the imperial dynasty. Land was nationalized, including the land that Selassie had previously given to foreigners, including the Rastas, which actually caused quite a few of them to flee the country. Now, this nationalization alone is not what caused the rift in the neighbors, but instead it's because in the country of Ethiopia, Selassie is regarded as a controversial and polarizing figure. Now, this in itself causes many to look sideways at those who might worship his memory and legacy. There are some in the country who have extreme love for Selassie, the one who was able to modernize the country and carve out a place out on the international stage. I'm sorry, not national, but international stage. But then others actually view Selassie as representative of the colonial empire, who was enamored by the luxuries of Europe and who did not leave the country in an equitable way. As we mentioned in part one, Selassie's coronation probably was about a $3 million affair for a country that couldn't really afford it. But there's also another issue as well that leads to the growing issues between the two groups, marijuana. As many can suspect and have heard, often through misconceptions, marijuana is considered an herb of religious significance by many Rastas, who even refer to the herb, as we said, as wisdom weed or holy herb. However, in the country of Ethiopia, this reverence is not widespread. In fact, Ethiopia regards marijuana as a dangerous drug, with the Ethiopian police sometimes raiding the settlements of the Rastafari, searching for it. The discrepancy between the official treatment of marijuana and heroin, cocaine, and other stimulant that's called cat leads to growing issues and mistrust between the Rastafari and the greater Ethiopian population. Now, one of the things that everyone knows Rastas for is their dreadlocks. However, again, in Ethiopia, the prevailing notion is that dreadlocks is indicative of bad behavior, and it's really looked at as being inappropriate. Now, further, it's often thought that any person who carries and really wears dreadlocks is not appropriate in public. And even worse, to the Rastafari, with regards to their neighbors, any person who believes Selassie was divine is thought of as being psychologically mad. Now, obviously, that does not bode well for the practicing Rastafari in Ethiopia. And so that really does kind of lead to the dissension amongst the ranks. But here's the ironic point to point out, though, and that's actually on the issue of marijuana usage and the founding and inspiration and the leadership of the Rastafari movement as well. Marcus Garvey campaigned against the use of marijuana, and Selassie is actually the one who outlawed its use in Ethiopia. So just like, again, an issue that we pointed out before, it seems that some of the belief systems of the Rastafari are counter to what the people who they revere the most actually believe, thought, and espoused. So I'm not going to be disrespectful. So it just seems counterproductive to celebrate something that the people who you hold in the highest esteem look down on very heavily. In more recent decades, the assimilation of the Rastafari into the Ethiopian populace has gained a good bit of traction, actually, with many Rastas marrying Ethiopians. But on the whole, these ethnic Ethiopian partners are not adopting the Rastafari movement as a way of life. Even those living in the country long term have mostly retained their British, American, or Canadian passports to permit themselves easier travel throughout the world, as taking dual citizenship and getting an Ethiopian passport has never really been possible. Now, that's actually a pretty good overview of the Rastafari movement in whole. Initially, we weren't really sure if it would be necessary to break Selassie into two episodes, but we had plenty of information to provide. And the funny thing is that when we were originally doing planning for this podcast series, we didn't have Rastafari on our list of planned topics. But it really would have been unfair for us to not at least touch on the subject, in at least its minimal form, while we were covering Selassie. But then once we kind of opened that rabbit hole of history and information, we decided we had to split Selassie into two episodes and give the movement its just due. Now, as with the Garvey episode being so recent in our archives and having Selassie as more of a recent topic as well, part one just last week, it really just made sense to devote a bit of time to explain the nuances and beliefs, especially as Garvey and Selassie really had heavy hands in the shaping of this movement. So though this was actually our longest episode to date, I really hope that we didn't bore you too much and we were able to make some sense out of the information as well for you. As I say all the time, I'm sure you've heard it and you'll hear it again, I'm not a huge fan of covering religions or beliefs, or in this case, movements, only because there's always something you're not able to cover correctly or misinformation that's given somewhere. And more than anything else, we want to be respectful as much to everyone within the diaspora as, you know, everybody's beliefs are important. Even if they're not important to me, they're important to them. And because of that, because I love you all as brothers and sisters, your beliefs are important to me as well. So I thank you for joining us today. In the event you have any questions or general commentary about this episode or part one, please feel free to visit our website at www.theblackhistorypodcast.com or www.thisiscarrington.com and navigate to the podcast tab at the top. I believe our 301 redirect should be working, so you can actually use www.thisiscarrington.com/podcast and it should take you directly to our website here. On our website, as we develop and grow, you will be able to find an archive of each episode, plans for our future episodes, as well as additional links to books and resources that will help you in your journey to self-enlightenment. We encourage you to share our episodes with your family, your friends, your grand... You know what? You know the deal. We encourage you to share our history with everyone, because our history is important. Send us your feedback as well. Suggest new topics, events, or people within the diaspora that we should cover. Or if you just wish to drop us a line and give us your thoughts or perspectives to an episode that we've done, we will make every best effort to include listener mail or commentary to our future episodes. You know, I definitely want to take a moment here as well to thank our first sponsor that we've pulled on to the Black History Podcast, Make Music Count. From everything that I know about the founder and CEO, as well as the program in itself, they're doing amazingly great things in the classroom, really helping our students, especially in more disadvantaged areas, learn math skills, and as well as learn the piano. And the way they're able to do that with really innovative and new songs, you know, so songs that you hear on the radio and pop culture are the songs that they're working with. So please check them out at makemusiccount.com. If you care to be a sponsor of the show, let us know as well. You can reach out to us through our website. But again, as we take this journey together, we will do our best to present the diaspora in the most objective light, with some occasional commentary presented. As always, if you come across any errors or mistakes, let us know, because as we like to say here, only steel can sharpen steel. Take care, and we hope you join us next week.